BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op studio in the centre of Bristol, right by Queen Square. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world, including, I'm told, South America, accessing the show on the internet. We have, in inverted commas, Paul in the studio today, a man who wishes to remain anonymous. He's from Bristol and he'll be talking on the problem of troublesome neighbours. We also have Marie-Christine Bouillet, a language teacher from Lille in the Pas-de-Calais, who's going to talk about the changing life in Provence in France and dowsing. And a feature from Tony Gosling on the mass murder of Afghan infants and the coming election. Malcolm Grease reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. And Jess Barks is back to bring us the very latest on what's going on in and around Bristol. I'm John Peters Cohen, presenter of this week's show, and I'd like to introduce Paul.
Hello, John. Hi.
Now, tell me a little bit about sort of roughly where you live in Bristol and your neighbourhood.
I live in the Bishopston area. I've lived there for the last 30 years.
So how have you found your sort of relationships with neighbours generally? Usually fairly congenial, I would presume.
Well, usually they've been quite good. I live in terraced accommodation. And after a few problems, personal problems, yes, I had occasion where my neighbour and I clashed horns on more than one occasion.
Okay, so what was the nature of this clash? What was your sort of first negative interaction with your neighbour?
Well, the first clash was in early May 2007, so my mother had actually only passed away a few months, and I heard somebody shouting through the wall, which was this neighbour. And we've been at loggerheads ever since. I personally tried to make peace with the man on three occasions, and it's gone on now for 30 months.
So what do you say it's gone on? I mean, what exactly?
There have been clashes. I mean, I had sleep deprivation. Sometimes it would go on till 4 o'clock in the morning. I had to walk around Bristol, let's say, if, you know where Lidl's is, down by Southmead, at the beginning of Southmead. I would walk over there, walk from there over to the top of Black Boy Hill, walk down. I might even almost do the journey again and then, come back through Southmead Hospital, eventually to settle down. At about
so that was to sort of tie yourself out?
5 o'clock, 4 or 5 o'clock, 5 o'clock, say 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
I have made overtures towards contacting the environmental health people, the police.
You've been at loggerheads or you've clashed. What has actually sort of happened that?
Well, I've had verbal abuse. One of the things I would not tolerate was being openly discussed in the garden with. It's caused a tidal wave of destruction in relation to my character. I've been accused of being homosexual, which is not true, although it's been very, very difficult. This went on sometimes night after night. Then I accepted the fact that with the sleep deprivation and the stress I was under, I thought, is there a chance this is coming from my own mind? It went on for 3-4 months at a time. I ended up in hospital. I was about 10 days in hospital.
So when you got back from your sort of walks to try and sort of tie yourself out, I mean, did you sort of wake your neighbours up? What did you do?
No. I've actually moved out now. I went down to my solicitor about it, and they've been very good solicitors, but they haven't got a leg to stand on themselves, because I could provide them with no evidence. Even if it was only 25%, it was sufficient to torture me. I've been tortured for nearly 3 years, and nothing has been done.
So if legally you can't really go any further, I mean,
I can do whatsoever. I'm being socially evicted from Bishopston by one person. I come across to most people now as a wailing, screaming, cranky maniac.
So a lot of people in Bishopston now know or think they know things about you because of one person spreading lots of things.
I have actually heard that man outside in his garden giving a verbal description of me, what's wrong with me, this and that and the other. And I overheard somebody else saying, "You're turning on my and my defence. You are turning this man into a nervous wreck." But at the end of the day, they go behind their closed doors. They do nothing. I'm in a situation where I feel where I can get no help. The only thing to do now is sell a house that I've been in, which is not even my own house, my mother's house, which I've been in for 30 years. This person moved into their property in the early 90s.
It was kind of difficult to know kind of what to say, really, because in a sense, I mean, you tried legally and nothing's gone any further with that. What you've actually moved now, so what
well,
are you
Well,
really
I've moved temporarily into the sort of Horfield, the deepest part of Horfield, border of Southmead area.
Yeah.
And I'm perfectly happy there, obviously, that I haven't got so much stuff around me that belongs to me. I tend to bring things in bags over, things like that, and I've had to do this 3 times. In fact, I ended up in hospital. I went down and approached this friend of mine who's not far from the hospital. I said, "I need your keys to this house. If I can't get away, I'm actually walking around the street in Northview. There's a wooden hut. I used to sit up there at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning."
Yeah. Have you contacted Citizens Advice?
There's nothing really that they can do. The thing is, I've got to record the man in for a flight.
Right. OK, well, we'll stop there. But I would say to everybody listening, if you've experienced similar problems to Paul, obviously, as we've known him, we would like to hear from you. So please email us on Bristol Radio Co-op. There's no hyphens in there. bristolradiocoop@hotmail.co.uk. And we'll keep tabs with you, Paul, and possibly try and get hold of your neighbour and see if we can go any further with this. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, from problems in Bishopston to a little taste of France. But what we played you there was Flambé Montalbanaise by Gus Fosseur and Son Orchestre. I'm not entirely sure what that means, whether that's it's an orchestra of some sort. And that's from Café de Paris, Accordion Classics. And I'm playing you up because I'd like to introduce to the studio Marie-Christine Bouillet, who's a language teacher from Lille on a visit to Bristol. Hello.
Hello.
You're here to talk about the changing pattern of life in Provence. Famously, of course, John Thor years ago made the television programme Living in Provence, and that persuaded a lot of people to go across to Provence and sort of set up and live there. Is there sort of quite a large British population now living there?
Yes. And the example I can quote is the village I know down there, which is called Cotignac. It's inland. It's not on the coast. It's not on the Riviera. Mm. It's a lovely little village situated at the foot of an enormous rock, and it's really very beautiful. And if the British hadn't come to this village in the 70s, it would have fallen into ruin, because because they actually saved the village. They bought the houses, they renovated the houses, so that was a very positive point.
Okay, so you're French yourself. Whereabouts in France do you come from?
I come from the north of France. I come from the Lille area.
Okay, and whereabouts is Provence for people who are...
Provence is about over 1,000 kilometres from where I live, from my hometown. But we bought a house down there about 10 years ago, so we tend to go there quite frequently, a few times in the year, and we get acquainted with the locals, which is quite nice too.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what the British, what the English sort of is. It mostly English? Do you get sort of anything from other nations in Europe?
It was at first a lot of English British people, and then more North Europeans came to this village of Cotignac I've just told you about.
Okay,
and I think now it's about populated 50% of foreigners. And 50% of local people. So that's really it gives the village a really an international atmosphere. It's really nice because these foreigners bring sort of their own cultures.
And it sounds like you know they've sort of enabled the village to sort of survive in a sense, because you're saying it was falling into ruin.
Yes. And for example, there are lots of English choirs. Which sound totally different from the Provençal choirs, you know, and the people are interested. The only criticism that could be made is only if the foreigners stick together, then the locals don't like that too much, because they appreciate if the foreigners open up. Try to make an effort to speak a bit of French. They don't have to be fluent, but just make the effort and don't stay in cliques, if you like. They of course they're not very well accepted.
They tend to do that quite a lot, do you think?
It's a bit of both, really. Some do, some don't.
Okay.
But for example, there's this story of this couple who were having, you know, every 14th of July, which is Bastille Day. They have this in all villages. You have dinners in the street, and people bring on their plates and things, and some food as well, and the town provides the wine or something like that. And you had this couple of Brits who just went at midnight when they played the Marseillaise. They sang their hearts out. They sang it really quite deeply, you know. And that was really nice. It was a good thing, you know. It was.
So, what are the sort of culturally, I suppose, apart from sort of them having a tendency to clump together? What do you think are sort of some of the good and bad points of sort of having?
I think the only bad point is what I've just told you. I think the rest is only positive, because you've got lots of artists who come to the south of the world to lead a different life, different type of life. The light is beautiful. The countryside is beautiful. Life is easy, of course. You think of the French drinking wine all the time, sitting at the cafe and watching people go by. It's a bit true. Life is very easygoing in the south, yes, more than in the north.
So tell me a little bit. You've got an amusing kind of story. Anthea, your friend, sort of told me a little bit about you, and she said, oh, ask her about this. And all I've got written down is Noel sorcerer water.
Yes,
and I'm
yes.
curious as to know what that's about.
Oh, that's in our little village. That's in the village where we bought the house. It's still in Provence.
In Provence,
but it's not Cotignac anymore. It's just a few kilometres away from Cotignac. And we met this very interesting and very original person a few years ago. And he can find the water, because we were interested in finding water in our garden, just because you need a lot of water when you live down there. So it was an idea. And people told us that he could find where the water was, you know. And so he just took out his knife and cut off a piece of wood from a tree there, just any tree.
Right.
And it was like a fork, if you like, and another sort of bit of branch, you know, and that would, he would hold both sides of the fork and then follow it. And then and the branch sort of went down where the water was.
Did you detect any sort of deliberate manipulation of this?
Well,
piece of
he asked my husband to hold the other bit of the fork.
Right.
If you like, they sort of held hands together.
Yeah.
And he was holding one part, and my husband was holding the other bit. And my husband said, I really tried very, very hard to resist it. And my husband is really strong. He's tall, he's big, he's strong.
Yeah.
And he couldn't. And he's a mathematician. He really believes in, Cartesian things. He's not too much of a poet. And he just couldn't resist it.
It's
amazing.
And then
Noel said he took some big stones and some small stones and said, you know, you want to know how deep the water is, and put in big stones and then put in small stones when I tell you. So my husband put in one stone.
What
two
did he
stone,
put them into?
In his hand,
in his
as
hand.
He was holding the fork.
Yeah.
And one big stone, two big stones, three big stones, four big stones, and then that was it. And then five small stones. And he said, well, it's 45 meters down. You'll have water.
Right. And did that work?
And yes.
I don't know. Okay, I'm skeptical, but
and
I'm prepared
quite,
to accept
it's quite,
the story,
it's quite popular. It's quite well known. It's amazing.
All right. Well, we'll have to get some more people in, perhaps, who know more about this and we can talk about it. What about pendulums? Do you think?
Oh, that's another little anecdote. I'll try to be short on that one. It's one night my son had been a bit loud with his friends, and one of the neighbours had complained, and he felt really, well, the garde champêtre, you know, that's in villages, you have like the village sort of constable.
Okay.
But he's an employee, he's employed by the town. It's an old word, but they still use that word, garde champêtre, came and said that a neighbour had complained. It was about midnight. So the next day, my son, just apologized and dropped letters in every letterbox sort of in the area. It's five neighbors we have. And then he went to Noel and said, well, I hope that you didn't complain last night. And Noel said, oh, no, of course I didn't complain. But if you like, we can try and find who complained. So he took out his pendulum.
Yeah.
And he just asked his pendulum, is it Robert? No, it's not Robert. Is it Georges? No, it's not Georges. Is it Serge? And then the pendulum just went like mad. And it was Serge. It was Serge. So the only thing we had to do, well, when we saw Serge a few months later, we just apologised for our son.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. And I understand you're off on a walking holiday in Sussex. You're going to enjoy some of the British countryside. So I hope you have a lovely time. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
This week was election week in Afghanistan, but the situation in the country means a democratic election is impossible. One Afghan member of parliament warns that if the real problems of drug lords and government corruption are not addressed in Afghanistan, then the same lawlessness will begin to appear on the streets of Britain. Malala Joya was elected to the Afghan parliament for Farah province in 2005, but suspended after accusing the government of corruption on Afghan TV. Speaking at a Stop the War meeting last month, she begins by talking about the fast worsening state for Afghan women.
Let me tell you a few examples about catastrophic situation of the woman. As on January, 14-year-old Shugufa has been kidnapped in Kabul under the nose and eyes of thousands of U.S. and eyes of troops. And her family, after 25 days, found her ravaged body on the garbage heap in the outskirts of Kabul. And she was the only daughter of a widow. That as there is no justice, of course, nobody listened the voice of this mother of my country. And Golafoz is another young girl who has been brutally raped in Sarpur province. When I'm going, I have planning to meet with them. And Bashira was another girl. In this book, you can read her story that this names can be increased in the list of rape cases. But as I said, unfortunately, there is no justice. Today in Afghanistan, killing of women is like killing of bird. And to know better about the deep tragedy, catastrophic situation of women in my country, tell you that example that on 8th of March, you Democrat people around the world, women especially, they celebrate this day with lots of hopes and happiness. But in my country, alone in this day, three women set themselves on fire. Because of these warlords, fundamentalists, and these Netherlands who are in power and continue to their fascism. And today they are not only women of my country, men and women right now, most of them do not have liberation at all, and they suffer from injustice, from insecurity, poverty, corruption, joblessness, and many problems like that. And I think only this example is enough to know about the wrong policy of your government, that after almost 8 years that not only they made Taliban powerless, they changed Afghanistan to the center of threat. Today 93% of opium produced from Afghanistan, and even found its way on the streets of US and Europe. And I'm sure if your government do not stop this wrong policy, and these drugs will find its way on the streets of UK and will destroy the lives of your youths as well. As the drug is dangerous even for the world, not only for people of Afghanistan. And through this dirty business of drug, every year $500 million goes alone into the pocket of Taliban. And since 2001 until now, 4,500% increase. Brother of Mohammed Karzai, Ahmad Wali Karzai, himself is a famous drug trafficker. They are saying to poor farmers that of my country, stop planting of opium, but the governors and commanders of the same provinces are famous drug traffickers. But lots of money through taxpayers from you people they are receiving, giving to such a mafia, corrupt government of Hamid Karzai, in the name of destroying the opium, I don't know, or bringing women rights or reconstruction of Afghanistan, education, etc. But most of money goes into pocket of these dirty-minded, corrupt warlords who are in power. I'm sure that millions of dollars the UK has donated is simply fatting the wallets of most criminals who are brother and creed of the Taliban. And today, the city of Kabul has been changed to the city of beggars. And right now, even I got report that Karzai banned biggering in Kabul, because most media is coming there in Kabul. In faraway provinces, they do not there, because situation is very risky for them. And two mothers of my country, in Herat and Ghor province, they ready to sell their babies for only $10, because just cannot feed them. And this list can be prolonged. To know more about corruption, I'm giving you some sources, like it's enough to see the Human Rights Watch website, like Amnesty International website, Transparency International websites, Rawa's websites, as it become like open secret for the people around the world. And now my people, they are between two powerful enemies. From the sky, these occupation forces are training, bombing, and killing civilians. Even they use white phosphorus, cluster bombs, they test on my suffering, innocent people of my country. And in the ground, Taliban and these North Alliance fundamentalists continue to their fascism against my people. And when, let me give you one example to know better about the role of these troops in Afghanistan. What happened in Farah province on May recently, that in one day more than 150 civilians has been killed, most of them was women and children, which is quite war crime under the name of Taliban. And after that, Karzai is going to a mosque in Farah and telling to my people that those who lost their wives, he can pay for their next marriage party. He put salt on the hearts of the injured hearts of my people. And it is not the first time that he's betraying my people, as since he came in power after 9/11, is still doing compromise with these warlords. But now again, this shameless puppet man running for presidential election, and has two vice presidents that he chose, is two infamous criminals like Qasim Fahim and Karim Khalidi, that even Human Rights Watch said Karzai insulting the people of Afghanistan by this act, but I'm saying no, he is betraying my people. And this election, this itself is a showcase in, for US government to deceive people around the world, as our people believe that only one puppet can be replaced with another puppet. We have no hope in this election. They, as a famous saying, it's not important who's voting, it's important who's counting. That's our problem. Except Dr. Ramzan Bashar, those most of candidates, they are discredited and known faces. That even some of them was minister of Hamid Karzai and worked with this mafia system and now running for the election. Anyway, our people have a proverb that recently one of them told me, Malala, it looks like an old donkey but with new saddle. And I agree with them.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Websites mentioned there, if you want to find out about human rights abuses by both Taliban and NATO forces, were Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International and Transparency International. And if you forget any of those addresses, of course, if you just Google them, then I'm sure they'll all come up. Malala Joya, it's worth pointing out, has a book out published by Macmillan called Raising My Voice. And I'd like to introduce in front of the microphone Mr. Tony Gosling, who made this feature possible. Hello.
Hi.
So, tell us a little bit about your angle on this.
Well, I think one of the things that I've noticed is that we've had a kind of a false debate about Afghanistan, which is that all the discussion has been about why is it that the army haven't released the figures of the number of wounded soldiers. We've had, obviously, just passed the figure of 200 killed in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And a lot of the debate and discussion over here has been about should we release the figures of the wounded? Why haven't they released the figures of the wounded as well? But what I would say is, from just a purely journalistic point of view and trying to balance the coverage, is that we should be looking at the Taliban casualties and we should be looking at the civilian casualties. Mm. So what I've been doing is sort of trawling around the internet to find some and it's actually very difficult to find some really good sources of information for what the casualties have been on the ground for the people of Afghanistan.
Yeah, because it recalls the incident when they tried to release what the casualty figures were in Iraq, and they sort of extrapolated a small number and then sort of said, well, this must be therefore the figure roughly for the whole country.
Well, and also,
surely it's very difficult just to recount whatever figure they come up with.
Well, it is extremely difficult. And the problem with Iraq was that they were widely disparaging disparate figures. Mm. For, you know, we were hearing from some sources 10,000 casualties, from other sources over 1 million casualties amongst the Iraqi people. Anyway, I did actually find one quite good report. Well, I say good report, but it's, well-sourced, and that is from UNICEF. And if you go onto the UNICEF website, United Nations International Children's Fund. That's www.unicef.org. And there's a section by different countries to look at the infant mortality rates around the world. And Afghanistan, because the place has been occupied for the last 8 years, is now coming up to be one of the worst infant mortality rates in the world. Okay. According to UNICEF, this is from their website and from their report on infant mortality in Afghanistan, we've heard them about 200 deaths of British soldiers, but there are 338,000 deaths of under five infants now every year in Afghanistan. Obviously, a large part of this is due to the war situation, and that is according to the UN Population Division, the under five infant population in occupied Afghanistan is currently about 5 million. And now what they're doing is also on the UNICEF site is translating this up into what is the total number of under five deaths since the occupation began. Now this isn't all due to the occupation, because obviously under fives die naturally anyway. Okay. But it makes a pretty shocking figure that since the beginning of the 8 year occupation, now a total of 2.3 million under fives have died in Afghanistan, which is much, much higher than it should be. And I think, just trying to put the record straight, this is trying to balance out what the Afghan people are suffering. And obviously we were hearing from the MP earlier on as well about her people suffering. And I think it's really important to understand that it's not just the British Army that are suffering. It's also the civilians and the people of Afghanistan too.
Well, maybe this is a desperate attempt to win the war by waiting there until they've all died and there's no one left to fight.
Well, you may flippantly say that, but the population in that country is going down an astronomical rate because of this occupation.
Okay.
And there are all sorts of questions being raised, thankfully, now about what is actually the NATO doing there.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. And, of course, there'll be plenty more about Afghanistan in the coming weeks if you keep your eagle ears open and listen to Dalek Radio. Following on from the theme of the Edinburgh Fringe from last week, our next feature from Dalek's Anthea Page, who is up there, mostly sitting in the press office, I understand. This is an interview with David Beakle, I think that's spelt, the producer of one of the four shows of Stop the Clock Productions.
Hello, my name's David Beck. I'm from Yatton near Bristol, and I am a producer for Stop Clock Theatre Company at the Edinburgh Festival this year. We are doing four productions, amongst them are Ed, Man Band, Foursome, and a play called Lucky Dip. And this is a short excerpt from that play. In just a few moments, we'll be inviting our contestants to enter these bathtubs. In order to win the £10,000, all they have to do is stay inside the tubs the longest. During our round-the-clock observation of them inside this greenhouse, we will be providing them with food and water. They will be allowed a bathroom break every 2 hours. Sounds simple, doesn't it? But who will have the mental endurance to last out? We'll find out in the next few hours, days, weeks, months, who knows? Contestants, enter the bathtubs.
Hiya. I'm Doug. Francis, isn't it? Oh, look, we both know we're going to be here for a long time, so we might as well get to know each other. Play a game together.
I'm tired.
You're tired now? You wait with these endurance competitions. The longer you wait, the more tired you're going to feel, especially in these bathtub ones. You give me an hour and I'll have a sweaty bummer or my pants will be stuck to it.
What?
I'm sorry, that's disgusting of me. I get nervous with all these crowds, and when I'm nervous, I say things that I shouldn't. I can't help it, I'm sorry.
It's okay, I'm not a prude. And thanks for the advice. Have you done a competition like this before?
I've done my fair share. And I might as well add, I can spot a fellow pro a mile off, so you can come out of it. You're a gamer.
Sorry?
You're a pro.
A pro what?
You work the circuit, don't you?
No, I came from work yesterday. I don't work any kind of circuit.
You were at work yesterday. You expect me to believe that? You're trying to fake me. It's not going to work. I've seen your type before.
Don't be ridiculous.
Where do you work?
I work in a small firm of solicitors.
What do you do?
Office administrator.
How much do you earn?
I'm not telling you that.
All right, what's your boss's extension number and his daughter's name?
6121, and he doesn't have a daughter. He has two sons called Benjamin and Edward.
Hoo-hoo, you're good. You're really good. A real piece of work. I love it.
Believe
Benjamin and Edward.
What you want. I don't really want to talk to you, and I don't care what you think I do for a living.
You're going to tell me what you do. Because you're proud. You're a pro. And you want to tell me.
Biggest win? 2 weeks all expenses paid, 5-star hotel in Dubai. Reader's Digest. All I had to do was a 5-piece spot the difference and a picture of Mylene Glass. Oh, it was majestic. I took my mum.
You won win. 3-minute shopping trolley dash. Entire shopping centre is in it. And I went straight to Comet, made off of 17 multi-region DVD players. I got that one in a word search in Puzzler. In flipping Puzzler. Can you believe that?
I got that soon. Prize draw, Regent Street Carnival Day. I'd set myself a competition float worth about $3,000. I'd employed 6 actors to work for me, and we got a full 3,000 entries in it by 11 o'clock that morning. Oh, I was a dead cert, but I was still nervous, you know, come draw time, because that's my money and I need that to keep playing. So, I drew 3rd place, won a 32-inch plasma screen worth about 1,500. I drew 2nd place. Oh, but that wasn't worth his standing. It was one of those pay your mortgage for a year, but...
Oh, yeah, they set it up for you and then you've got
to... You have to transfer over with their own
bank.
Yeah,
that's complete nonsense when they do.
Yeah, it's rubbish. Anyway, I pulled 1st place. Brand spanking Mini Cooper. Sold it the next day for £13,000.
What did you do with the flat screen?
Oh, my ex chucked it off the top of a car park for a laugh.
For a laugh?
Yeah, he had a passion for smashing things.
Wow. Well, hello, hustler.
Sorry, I couldn't deceive you any longer. I like to win. I've always found that acting the novice puts the competition off guard. Well, in these type of events.
Yeah, well, you didn't bank on me.
Neither did you on me. Now I've shown my colour, surely you must be a little worried. I'm a 10-year pro competition winner.
Not a relish to competition, dear lady. We'll see how long you last.
I'm not going anywhere.
Well... We'll see how long you last. That was an excerpt from Lucky Dip by Stuart Price, and it starred Neil Frost and Catherine Morris. Lucky Dip was previewed at the Etc. Theatre in Camden in March of this year, prior to coming up to the festival, and now runs at C+2 at 1:30 every day from the 5th till the 31st of August.
How did it go down in Camden?
Very well, yeah. We've done it a few times prior to that as well in Liverpool at the Unity Theatre and as well as in the West End in London.
How did you all get together?
The majority of us all went to drama school together in Liverpool at LIPA, Paul McCartney's drama school. And then a couple of guys from the years below at LIPA have also got involved. And then through various projects that we've done in London between us, we've kind of put together the rest of the company.
Is this your first year at Edinburgh?
No, we did when the company, when it was kind of in its infancy, was more of a student company, and we did directly after LIPA, we did a show then, which went very well, and then kind of has grown since then, and we kind of changed the name and tried to make it more of a professional company. We did a show in 2006, which went well, took a couple of years off to kind of build it up to a level where we could do this venture, which is massive, really, in comparison to anything we've done before, so hopefully it will work out for us.
Well, you're from Yatton. Any chance to come to Bristol with any of the productions?
Love to. Yeah, I used to go to the Old Vic quite a lot when I was a kid as part of the youth theatre and that there. So, I mean, that might be a bridge too far at the moment, but the Tobacco Factory certainly.
That was Anthony Page talking to the producer of Stop the Clock Productions. It's now time for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read excellently in his honey tones by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. Eagle-eared listeners will remember from previous weeks, if you've been listening. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary. And if you're interested, the intro music we're about to use is a tune called Old Molly Oxford and was performed by musicians in the Royal Naval Volunteer Pub, which is in King Street in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. E.V. Lucas has written a whole column about this place in the Sunday Times in his best style for these articles, not naming it but giving a liberal clue. The only immediate result of this delightful bit of reading by the public was the coming today of a pleasant old lady who told me she'd promised a show for 10 shillings if he could discover the place and get her there. What touched me most in Lucas's article was that he was not afraid to call me a gentleman and insist upon it. It isn't easy to be one, especially in an inn, In fact, no man can safely be called a gentleman till he's dead, or 80, or has kept an inn. But to be called one is at least encouraging in the struggle. Once a man told me, for no good reason on that occasion at least, that I was no gentleman, and I was glad to coin the only possible reply to this old cliché by saying, I make no pretence to being a gentleman, so we may continue the discussion on equal terms, a don-like tu quoque. Mr. and Mrs. Earle came Monday to lunch from London, a dear, affectionate old couple who treated me with cosy cheer. She told me of Mrs. Jopling Rowe's tea party for old friends, herself 83, about 40 of them, including old Sir Dighton Probyn, 95, with an average age of about 80, and all upstanding and getting about. Mrs. Earle said her grandfather was still earning a living at 96. And Mrs. Budd, another amiable old lady, came from Oxford with a couple. Grow old with me is not a bad sentiment, if you can be as nice as these, and have nice tea parties. Some say what a good book Sorrel and Son was. The fellow who took an hotel and made it pay for his son's sake. Well, he was out for money, primarily. Not I. When I find a commodity better and more expensive than what I have, I buy it. It may pay in the end, or it may not, but it's only polite to give good things to good people. It does seem strange, but I think no better meal was eaten in England this evening than ours, with that saddle of Welsh mutton got from Mrs. Walker's Lake Vernuey Hotel, which you press to the roof of your mouth and it melts into puree. Yet no one came to eat it, and tomorrow it will melt in the stockpot. Oliver Baldwin and John Fernald, president of the OUDS, dined. Oliver has a real heart, but is so wrought in himself that talking to him is merely listening. He sold us, for threepence, a raffle ticket from some trades council, the winner to have a free tour to Brussels and Paris, presumably in laborious solitude. I asked him if he would take one of our one-penny Primrose League tickets for a community tour to the North Pole, where they would all be left, ministers and all. And he said, on that condition, he would take one. Gerald Dillon, accountant, came for the night, once a Balliol scholar, and I should think he will be a great man in this line. Like Humbert Wolfe, he has an amazing repertoire of romances, all told in the language of truth, and, like Humbert Wolfe, he believes them. Clever devils. Major Hunter Smith, instructor at Sandhurst, and his pretty young wife are lovely in their unaffected ways. As he likes port and burgundy, I am putting him through a course of claret. They must be thought odd at Sandhurst. John Tyer and a friend Craig came to dinner, the only gents inside these walls today. J.T. and his friend Vere Pilkington, when at Oxford, were self-conscious and at effort to converse. Suddenly, they've become natural, John Tyer a thinking talker and V.P. a talking thinker. Rubbish. George Ely, Oxford University Press, brought dear old Robert Steele, the Bacon scholar, and Miss Peacock. Steele told me of the perfect tobacconist. He had occasionally got some Manila cigars at Van Ralt's, till, owing to the Philippine War, they ceased, and Steele ceased also to go there. 15 years after, he went in again, when the tall, handsome man at once leant over to him and said, "We have some of those Manila cigars now, sir." I told him I couldn't aspire to that as the perfect hotel keeper, much as I tried. I didn't tell Steele that no one but a blind man would fail to recognise him again after any period, with a face like two little bright red polished apples and an eyeglass hung on black silk 2 inches wide. But the other day a man came to dinner and I said to him, "You've been here before?" "Yes," said the man. "And," I conjectured, thinking hard, "it must have been some 2 years ago." "No," said the man. "It was at tea time." Plimsoll says he doesn't believe the story, but Kate witnesses that I told her of it at the time. Dr. Waterfield, Guy's, came with one of kind Connie Beer's treats to his staff. As he was writing a lecture on astronomy, I asked him if he ran both sciences, astronomy and medicine. "Medicine isn't a science, it's a superstition," he snapped. Plimsoll and Enid had Thursday till Wednesday holiday from secretaryship of Middlesex Hospital. They went to Dieppe, got sick of it in 6 hours, and came straight here. Impetuous compliment. It's curious to think that this young man is the son of the historical Plimsoll, who, I discover, is called in the small Oxford dictionary a 19th century agitator. impetuosity again, in the third generation, for today, 6 years later, their pretty little daughter, Barbara, brought her young man out here for after-dinner coffee. 94 miles in all. A new, picturesque and delightful couple, the Camerons. He, Director of Education, City of Oxford. She, Elizabeth Bowen, brought friends to dinner. Their party had, as always since, the bright air of a dinner party. Mrs. Cameron, with a pleasant bite in her looks, behaves as if she'd just been set free from the pathetic company she writes about so satirically. Edgar Lobel, the Sappho King, brought his nice folk to dinner from Oxford. He is an epicure, and good to look at. When I told him of a certain new college wine epicure, he said he didn't know the difference between wine and turps. When I told him this evening that he would like Chateau Montrose 1918, since Wade Geary had liked it so much, he said, "Good Lord, Geary has no taste at all." And only for an instant it struck me to reply, "Now, when Geary were here last, that's exactly what he said about you." Lobel will argue anything, even to my pet discovery that the sun has never seen a shadow, and so could have no conception of three-dimensional form. He said that I assumed that the sun was the only light. What about the stars, even in daytime? I replied that there might, of course, be a man lighting a cigarette on the mountainside. "Yes, that's just my point," he said. "Well," I replied, "and it's just a Euclidean point." The other day, Lobel came to tea to give dictionary authority, but rare and antiquated for his using the word exception rather than excision as an act, and I gave him the usual pot of Greek honey for winning the bet. I told him it was disgraceful for a distinguished scholar to make profit thus out of ignorant publicans. In fact, it seemed to be his only source of livelihood.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm delighted, as I always am, to invite Jeff Sparks to sit down and take a seat and tell us about what's going on. I'm quite alarmed to see you're not wearing any black today at all.
No, it's too hot for that today.
Too hot, but only the only thing that's black is the pupils of your eyes, the hypnotic darkness. Tell us what's going on.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio, starting with Friday 28th of August and the Infirm, Gurkha, Hammers, Nesseria and Turvit Cadet will all be performing as part of the three-day International Punk Festival at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. First band on stage at 7:30pm, entry is £7. Also on 28th of August, the Compadres will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. The event starts at 6pm and entry is free. Moving on to Song of the Week, our feature at Municipal Waste. This group hail from Richmond, Virginia, and during their 8-year career have released 3 albums, and on August the 24th, they will release their 4th album, titled Massive Aggressive. And this is a track from that album, and it's titled Shredded Offering.
Place. No one, you're the only one who's here to make a change.
That was Municipal Waste with Shredded Offering from the forthcoming album Massive Aggressive. For more information, you can check out www.myspace.com/municipalwaste. Moving on to Saturday, 29th of August, and the A-Heads, Social Parasites, War System, The Horror, Last Legion Alive and Doomsday Hour will all be performing on day two of the International Punk Festival at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. First band on stage at 6 p.m. and entry is £8. Also on 29th of August, Little Stampede, Monkey Chuckle and Six Toys will all be performing at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to a Sunday, 30th of August, Jesus Bruiser, War Prayer, Cut the Reins and many more bands will be performing on day 3 of the International Punk Festival at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The first band goes on stage at 6 p.m. and entry is £6. Also on 30th of August, Ian Briggs and the Super Vampers will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Monday, 31st of August, Nectar will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. And to finish the show, we have an interview with Heather Ash, one of the performers from the Trowbridge Village Punk Festival.
We're sitting here in the Manor House, having a cream tea, which we've just ordered, looking forward to very much, at Farley Hungerford, near Trowbridge. My name is Heather Ash.
Can you tell us about your folk club?
Yes, it's Mendip Folk. It's been going for 20 years. We haven't been doing it all that time. We've been doing it the last 10 years. That's my husband and I, Vince Ash and Heather Ash. And we've just recently moved to Priston, and we've got a fantastic venue now. It's in a little village hall, not far from Canesham. But it's about 8 miles from Bristol, I suppose, and about 8 miles from Bath. It's kind of sort of in the middle, but in the country. And we've moved to a village hall now because we've tried different pubs, function rooms, and because I think landlords are struggling so much at the moment to make money, that what was happening was that they kept getting bookings and cancelling our club the sort of night before, which is understandable. They've got to make money, but it was quite difficult for us to let everybody know in time. So we decided to move to a little village hall, which luckily is semi-detached from a pub, so we can go and get a drink and take it into the hall, which is great.
Can you tell us about your grand opening night?
Oh yeah, September the 11th is the start of our new season, and we've got some really good guests. There's Mike Scott, who writes his own songs, sort of in the vein of Loudon Wainwright III. He writes really good songs. He's written one song about taking his grandson to an ice cream parlour, his grandson flicking ice cream at him, and them both getting in a state and having a row, and then it's all, they end up laughing. He writes brilliant songs. So there's him, and then there's Andrew Baisley, who's a very kind of authentic blues guitarist. He's got a 1918 Gibson guitar, which is really authentic. And then there will be, and they sing sort of funny thought songs, songs in harmony but funny songs, things like the Everly Brothers, and then they do some Flanagan and Allen things. So it'll be a real mixture, it'll be a really nice night. September the 11th.
Can you tell us a bit about the two songs you're now going to sing in the marquee?
Yeah. The first one is a song from the Shetland Islands. It's called The Silky of Sewell Skerry. The second song is an English song, yeah. It was from the singer Van Briggs, who was a lovely singer, who was, I think she's still singing now, I'm not quite sure about that, but she was very popular in the sort of folk revival times of the 1960s, and I loved her singing. It's called The Snow It Melts the Soonest, and it's really about the fact that women need to be strong and just carry on with their lives, irrespective of whether their men are attendant or not, or go off to sea. She still holds her own, whatever he does to her. Thank you very much. It's another traditional song. And the singing of Anne Briggs. The snow, it melts as soon as when the wind begins to sing. And the corn, it ripens fastest when the frost is setting in. And when a young man tells me that my face he'll soon forget, before he goes a better ground, he'd be fain to follow me yet. And the snow, it melts the soonest when the wind begins to sing. And the swallow flies without a care as long as it is spring. But when spring goes and winter blows, my love, then you'll be free with all your fame to follow me where across the stormy seas. Oh, the snow, it melts the soonest when the wind begins to sing. And the bee that flew when summer shone, in winter he won't sting. And all the flowers in all the land, as bright as they may be, still the snow it melts the soonest when my love is for me. So never say to me farewell, no farewell I'll receive. You may meet me at the stile, or kiss and take your leave. But I'll wait here till the woodcock calls, or the martin flies in spring. Since the snow it melts the soonest when the wind begins to sing.
That was Heather Ash talking about Priston Folk Club, which opens on the 11th of September. That's a bit of an ominous date. Let's hope it all goes well. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. In the studio were, in inverted commas, Paul from Bristol, Bishopstone specifically, previously, Marie-Christine Bullier from Lille in the Pas du Nord in France, and Malcolm Grieve read another chapter excellently of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Jeff Sparks brought us What's Going On in Bristol, and the studio engineer was Mark Condon. The producer was Anthea Page. Well, let's hope the good weather continues so that the new fashionable short-sleeved Jeff can stride forth in Bristol and wow us all. Goodbye from all of us from Queen Square. Enjoy the summer, and we'll see you next week.